We're going to be in Daniel chapter 5 this morning, continuing in our study of this book. And if you recall, last week we covered Daniel chapter 4, and we talked about Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the great tree and what that tree represented and what it meant for him and his kingdom. He had this great vision in chapter 4 where he saw a tree that was so great and tall that it covered the whole earth. And during the course of this vision, the tree was cut down and turned into a stump. And that stump was allowed to stay rooted in the ground for a period of time. And we read of how the stump was covered with the dew of heaven and that it remained that way for a period of time. And Nebuchadnezzar was very struck by the implications of this dream, and he, in his usual fashion, called together all of his conjurers and magicians, and he also called Daniel, and Daniel was the one who was able to tell him that this tree represents you, and the cutting down of this tree represents the time when your power and your authority is going to be taken from you, but you'll still remain alive, and you'll still remain, in some sense, in your kingdom. Just the way the stump was rooted, it still retained its root system. The king would not be completely removed, and at some point, it would be returned to him. And so all of this was told to King Nebuchadnezzar, and we read of how shortly thereafter, he was standing on the roof of his palace, and he had this very prideful moment, right, where he looked out over his kingdom, and he looked down from his palace, and he said, "Is this not the great kingdom of Babylon that I, Nebuchadnezzar, have created for my own majesty and my own glory?" And that was the moment when God humbled him. That was the moment when God said, "Your power and your kingdom are going to be taken from you until you humble yourself and you realize where the source of your power truly is." And so we talked about that quite a bit last week, and I shared that for me that chapter is very sobering, because even though I'm not a king of a great empire, and none of you are kings and queens of a great empire, I've often felt like in our society and in our culture, we live like kings and queens relative to other parts of the world today and relative to the way people have lived throughout human history. The number of choices and the number of comforts and the amount of control that we have over our comfort level is unparalleled and unprecedented. And that we can easily fall into this trap. We can easily look at our own life and our own situation and the things that we have accomplished for ourselves and glorify ourselves. We can say to ourselves, "I'm so glad that I made that choice. I'm so glad that I made those decisions." Or, I'm glad that I worked as hard as I did during those years, because now look what I have." When really, if we think about the opportunity that we had to do that work, or the opportunity that we had to make those decisions, or the wisdom that was imparted to us, either by our forebears or from Scripture, that ultimately helped us make the decision that we made, it's impossible not to trace our blessings and our situation back to some kind of provision from the Father. And we've got to keep a hold on that. We've got to keep that in our grip. It's slippery because of the temptations that the enemy throws in front of us. It's slippery because of how many options and how many temptations we have in the land around us. But we've got to hold on to that somehow, because we can see through the lesson of King Nebuchadnezzar that God does not like a proud heart. He does not like it when people start to give themselves credit for their position, too much credit. So that was the application that I pulled out of chapter 4. Danny and I were talking about it later, and he summed it up, I think, better than I did. He said, it's the downfall of a prideful person. His power went to his head. And that can happen to all of us, for sure. I wanted to just refresh everyone's minds on the lessons that we pulled out of chapter 4 for just a few minutes, because this morning in chapter 5, there's very much going to be a parallel to that, maybe more like a sequel to chapter 4. Today's text tells of another vision that was interpreted by Daniel, but this vision is given to a different king. And before we get into the text, I wanted to spend a few minutes covering this chronological gap that I think exists between chapters 4 and 5. If you think back to the first couple of lessons that we got into, as we started talking about Daniel, we were looking at timelines. We were looking at how old Daniel might have been when he was taken into exile. Does anybody remember what we concluded? How old do you think Daniel was when he was taken captive by King Nebuchadnezzar?
Late teens.
Late teens? Sure. Late teenager, mid-teenager, somewhere in there. Young man. Probably not, you know, Reed's age. Probably older than that, but able to reason, able to learn, and able to be identified visually as a fine specimen of a prospective wise man, right? So that was right around 605, 606 BC on the timeline that we talked about. And we talked about how it's likely that he was taken captive during Nebuchadnezzar's first siege of Jerusalem, of which there were how many?
Three
sieges. So I wanted to try to put chapter 5 onto the timeline as much as we can, because I think it's helpful to form the picture in your mind of what's going to happen in chapter 5. When you're reading a story, it is always helpful to know things like how old people are. Because when you're reading a story and a new character is introduced, you immediately start to form this image based on what the author is telling you about what they're wearing and what they're saying and the kinds of things that they say. Maybe the author doesn't tell you right off the bat this person is 58 years old, but maybe you start to get a feel for how old they might be because of the other details. In chapter 5, we're actually not given a lot of detail about Daniel himself. We're given a fair amount of detail about the scene that's about to unfold with this new king. But there's a lot of information that's available to us through archaeological finds and through historical records, and also through the correlation between those accounts and what we see in Old Testament texts that can kind of help us figure out how much time has passed, how old are these people, how old is Daniel. And I hope that as we look at that, that'll help you solidify in your mind's eye what is going on in this chapter. So let's look at a sequence of rulers of Babylon from Nebuchadnezzar all the way to Belshazzar, who is the king in chapter 5 of Daniel. So we talked about this a few weeks ago. Nebuchadnezzar is thought to have come to power in 605 after his father, whose name is, remember, it was a really common name. You bump into people all the time, Nabopolassar. His father was defeated, and it's thought that maybe Nebuchadnezzar was on his way back to Babylon to take the throne when he took Daniel and his three friends captive. And then Nebuchadnezzar, if you look through not only the Old Testament, but also some other texts that we're going to talk about just briefly, is succeeded by his son, Amel-Marduk, or Evil or Evil Merodach. How'd you like to have that name? Even if you are pronouncing it as Evil, not really a great name as far as we're concerned. But in 2 Kings chapter 25, we read of this person who succeeds Nebuchadnezzar. That's thought to have happened around 562 BC. And then there's a series of chaotic things that take place as far as who is ruling in Babylon. This successor of Nebuchadnezzar is assassinated, and Nergal-Sharezer is able to assume power because of his marriage with one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters. So it's kind of a political marriage, if you want to think about it that way. He's able to take power and the seat of power in Babylon through that marriage. And that brings us down to 560 BC. So Nebuchadnezzar's successor is only thought to have been in power for about 2 years, which is a fairly brief period of time considering how long previous kings are in power and how long kings after that are going to stay in power. And I hope I'm not boring you to death yet with the dates. There are some other transitions that take place. I'm not going to say this right. Labishi Marduk had a brief period where he ruled for about 9 months. It's thought that he was assassinated through a plot that was formed by the priestly party, and that rule did not last very long. He was actually assassinated later on, and Nabonidus became the king of Babylon through his marriage to another one of Nebuchadnezzar's offspring, which again seems to have been done to legitimize his rule in Babylon. Why do I go through all of that? Do you care about all these names? Probably not. But look at the dates. Look at how much time has passed. How much time has passed, roughly, from the end of Nebuchadnezzar's rule to the end of Nabonidus' rule. Nabonidus's. Sure. So this kind of helps us figure out how old Daniel might be at this point. I think about 23 years gap exists between, let me make sure I'm doing this right. Yeah, the end of Nebuchadnezzar's rule to the end of the rule of Nabonidus. Right, 23 years? Am I doing the math right? Okay. Now, how old was Daniel again when he was taken into captivity? Late teens is what we said. So I don't know for sure, but I would conjecture that maybe 66 years roughly pass from the time that Daniel is taken captive to the end of the chapter that we're about to study. And, you know, maybe the end of the chapter is a better time to make that point. But I make it now so that you can picture the Daniel that is about to walk before King Belshazzar. How old do you think Daniel is? He's in his 80s. I think we can safely conclude that Daniel is a very aged person at this point. No offense to anybody with us tonight or this morning. But that's really the time frame that we're talking about. 66 years is a fair bit of time. And that may not be obvious to you as, you know, as we begin the chapter. A couple of more things I want to point out real quick. Some of the information on the previous slide, you might be sitting there going, well, that's really neat, but how do you know that? There's a lot of commentaries at your disposal if you're going to study something like this. And what I've found is that sometimes when I'm reading a commentary, the author will start to say, and this king, followed this king, and then he reigned for this period of time. And as we know, he was assassinated by this guy, and then this followed on. And it all sounds very scholarly and reliable. But then it just goes right on to the next section, and there's not really any citations given. There's not any references made to where that information came from. Whereas other times I'll be reading a workbook or a documentary, or a commentary rather, and it's just full of these references, which is really helpful. But in either case, I usually try to follow up on some of it. I do as much fact-checking as I can, because this is serious business. We're trying to draw conclusions and pull lessons out of God's Word. So what I wanted to share with you next are some things that I think are pretty valid and pretty validated by peer reviews and scholarly efforts. This is a picture of a clay cylinder. There are actually four of these cylinders that were discovered in the 19th century. And on these cylinders, what you read is a prayer of Nabonidus. And again, Nabonidus was a successor of Nebuchadnezzar after the throne had changed hands a few times. And Nabonidus, we know because of this cylinder, is the father of Belshazzar. And that was a point that was contested for a while. Critics of the book of Daniel and of scripture in general challenged the notion that Belshazzar really could have been in any kind of authority in Babylon during this time period. And then these cylinders were discovered. And on this cylinder is a prayer to, I believe it's the moon god that Nabonidus acknowledged and worshipped for his son Belshazzar. And so it's one of the clues that has helped us tie the book of Daniel to historical knowledge and archaeological discovery. So with this discovery, we can at least point to something physical, something from the historical record of the earth, and say this is where it ties together. There's also another clay tablet. This is known as the Nabonidus Chronicle, and it was discovered about 30 years later after the cylinders were found. And on this tablet, there's a number of things that are recorded. But what we conclude is that Belshazzar was probably an absentee king or maybe a co-regent with his father Nabonidus. So in other words, they're both in power at the same time. Belshazzar is not necessarily the only king of Babylon. He's not above his father, but he does have power. And that's one of the things that you can pull off of this tablet. I'm not a cuneiform or Akkadian scholar, so I'm not going to try to, you know, read it for you or point to which line this information is pulled from, but I'm trusting that the qualified scholars and archaeologists that have translated this are giving us a true and accurate record of what it says. It also implies that Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, was away from Babylon at the time that it was attacked by the Medes. And he had actually fled the city because the Medes were marching on Babylon and he decided to get out of there. And I think it's possible, as chapter 5 opens and we start to read this account, that that's the reason for the feast that's being thrown. And that's not an original idea with me. That's something that's been proposed by others. But that's the setting. I wanted to give you that. I hope that's helpful. That's the background and the undercurrent that leads us into chapter 5. Several kings have come and gone since Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel is still in Babylon. And we have this co-regent, or stand-in king Belshazzar, who's throwing a feast. So beginning with chapter 5 and verse 1. Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. The king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. So King Belshazzar holds a feast for 1,000 of his nobles. And after tasting the wine and making merry with his nobles, he decides to do what?
Basically make a mockery of the god of the Hebrews by bringing their stuff they had in the treasury and using it as everyday stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, he decides, let's take it up a notch. Let's go ahead and get the plunder from the temple in Jerusalem, bring it out here, and let's use that to make merry. Let's add that element to the celebration. And as they drink from the vessels that were stolen from the temple, they praise several false gods while they're doing this. Could this scene... Sure, great point. If you didn't hear what Alan said, he said they're basically praising things that God created. They're worshiping things that the Almighty God created, right? Could this scene be any more offensive to the Most High God? I mean, maybe. You know, it's irony, in a way, that vessels from the temple would be used in an activity that is so blatantly offensive to the God of that temple, right? I was struggling to think of, you know, some kind of a parallel, and I just can't. I can't think of one. It is really offensive. And, you know, like Alan pointed out, maybe that was Belshazzar's point all along. Dwayne. Say that again.
The Roman general who conquered Jerusalem offered a swine on the altar in Jerusalem.
Okay. Yeah. Brian?
Well, we'll talk about it in about four chapters when we talk about Antioch as Epiphanes who did it.
Yeah, we're going to get there. Dwayne and Brian were just pointing out that, you know, later on there's either Roman or a Greek general that offers the swine on the altar in Jerusalem. Again, just a complete defamation. Yeah.
One of the things that's, two points on this. One, some commentaries theorize that the reason why Belshazzar's holding this feast is to kind of maintain unity amongst the nobles, because they know the Medes and the Persians are headed this way. So it's kind of make sure everybody's on the same page because we're about to fight together.
Yep.
The other thing I just think is interesting is after the implements are taken from the temple in chapter 1 and they're brought here, this is the kind of first mention we have of them since then. But then we're going to hear about them again in Ezra when they're given back to the Israelites and the Jews to take Jerusalem. To me, it's just impressive to consider, especially when in Ezra you see how much stuff this is, like how much gold and silver it is, that it wasn't melted down or sold off or used for, it wasn't destroyed in any way. That this stuff maintained itself, or God maintained it, within the treasury of multiple Gentile kingdoms, so that eventually it would make its way back to the temple.
Yeah, that's a great point. If you didn't hear Adam's comment, he was just pointing out that these items could have easily been melted down and turned into something else more pleasing, perhaps, to whoever owned it. And it's interesting that these implements are actually going to survive, as near as we can tell, all the way to when they're returned to the temple in the book of Ezra. And I've honestly not studied that as much as I probably should have. But that is interesting. You know, you look at how God preserves things through the ages for his purpose. That's something that you see over and over in the Bible. So this supernatural event occurs. A hand appears and writes text on the wall. And we're told in great detail the impact that that had on King Belshazzar. He becomes terrified. His body starts betraying how terrified he is. And just as a side note, you know, this story causes many people to quote Scripture without even knowing it. You know what I mean by that? The writing on the wall, right? People say that all the time. The writing is on the wall. So, blah, blah, blah. But it's foreshadowing. You know, it's when someone wants to say, we're inevitably approaching this certain outcome. The writing's on the wall.
People, it's always bad.
It's always bad. People say that in sports. They say it in politics. People are saying that at the company I work for right now because we're being acquired by a bigger company, which is a lot of fun. It's the third time I've been through it. And that phrase comes up a lot. You know, the writing is on the wall, so be prepared. Bad stuff's coming. So we see Belshazzar call in the usual suspects, right? The Chaldeans and the conjurers, and they're of absolutely no help. As far as Daniel is concerned, they never have been. You know, I kind of wonder if there was ever a time when a king was actually helped or assisted in some way by the charlatans that went under those names. But imagine for a second that you don't know what's coming next. I think a lot of us studying Daniel this morning do, because we've studied this before. But imagine this is the first time you're reading Daniel. And up to this point, what question might you have? I mean, you've already read about King Nebuchadnezzar bringing the magicians and the wise men and the conjurers in to give him the meaning of a dream. And here's Belshazzar doing the same thing. And already, as a reader of Daniel for the first time, you've read that Daniel was the only one that was able to do it, right? The question I might have, I don't know about you, is Daniel still around? If you're reading this for the first time, is Daniel even still alive? Is he even in Babylon? Why in the world wouldn't they just go straight to him? Let's continue on in verse 10. The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I have heard about you, that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now these wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. You know, I think verse 10 is saying that the queen overheard what was happening in the banquet hall. And she heard what they were talking about, and she entered to make this suggestion and inform her king of Daniel's existence. But who is this queen exactly? Who do you think this queen is? The queen mother? Right.
And that was significant because having knowledge of those past events, she said, hey, check this out.
Right. Donna? Sure. So the
she's on that path.
Right.
She's potentially either Nabonidus's or maybe even Nebuchadnezzar's wife. So she could be Belteshazzar's mother. Well, or mother-in-law.
Great-grandmother-in-law. Sure. Sure.
But similar to Esther, her entering the presence of the king was a bit dicey, and it appears she wasn't invited.
Right. So, thank you for making that point. It appears that the queen was not already in the king's presence. She was not already a part of this ceremony, or of this feast. And since she knows about Daniel, I think personally, from personal experience, it doesn't really sound to me like she's heard about this guy. And she's telling the king, I've heard about this guy. According to the legends of your great-grandfather, there was this guy, Daniel. Likely that she's the queen mother, maybe even Nebuchadnezzar's wife, but certainly a predecessor and somebody whose lifetime overlaps. In 23 years, like we talked about a moment ago, that's long enough, but that's short enough, that certainly that could be possible. Did the queen mother have more influence? You know, I think maybe somebody who's actually a scholar could answer that question. I don't know the answer to that question. Certainly she had the freedom to enter, right? She had the freedom to come in. I don't know that her authority would have superseded Belshazzar's. It's also really not clear to me from either the text or any of the historical information that I shared earlier that Belshazzar has a queen at his side. I mean, I'm sure he does, but I don't know that for certain, seeing as how Nabonidus has sort of appointed him as co-regent rather than him succeeding his father. Dwayne?
She was hobnobbing with the wives of concubines. The fact is, she came in.
Sure.
They were already there. That fact is there, but I do not know why.
Any other comments or questions on that? Yeah. Oh, okay.
So I was going to say, this is another one of those chapters that feels like a story that's to be told. Like, it's not just a historical account, and then there was writing on the wall, and Belshazzar was alarmed, and then Daniel came in. There's lots of touch points of drama. His knees knocked together.
Right.
His color changed.
Sure.
You know, things like that. And then when Daniel enters, there are descriptions of Daniel that again bring to mind storytelling. Are you that Daniel? Not just
yeah.
Are you some Daniel who walks around, or are you that one?
Right.
And you know, it's kind of a big reveal as a story that like we should tell this to our children in that voice.
Yeah, great point. It's another text in Daniel where it feels like it's written to be told, right? This is a captivating story that is easy for the teller to remember and convey on to someone else. Lots of rich detail that brings it out, especially the detail about King Belshazzar's reaction to the hand. So Daniel's reputation precedes him, at least with the queen. And Daniel is offered a great reward if he can interpret this dream. Now, what is significant about the offer to make Daniel third in the kingdom?
His provision he could not give him.
Exactly. If Belshazzar is second to Nabonidus, three is the highest that Belshazzar can offer to Daniel. Depending on how you look at that, I guess. Now, I just wanted to point that out because third in the kingdom of anything is a pretty high rank. But it's worth noting that this is the highest that Belshazzar can offer him. So what is... go ahead, Adam.
He also apparently has a different means of motivating than Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar always threatened everyone's life.
Yeah.
They didn't get what he wanted. I don't know if Belshazzar had some reason to change how he motivated people, but at least he's using carrots instead of sticks.
Yeah, great
maybe,
point.
Maybe a better guy to work for. I don't know.
Maybe so. Well, continuing on in verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, keep your gifts for yourself or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive. And whomever he wished, he elevated, and whomever he wished, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts. And his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this. But you have exalted yourself because the Lord of heaven, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines, have been drinking wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life breath and all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. I want to pause there for a minute before we talk about the inscription. What is Daniel's response to this great offer that Belshazzar has made? Yeah, he turned it down flat. Sure, and that answers the next question I was going to ask. You know, why do you think he was so disinterested? He says, you can keep your robe and your gold and all your power that you're offering me, but I'll go ahead and do the interpretation anyway. There you go. So those are the two explanations I came up with. Maybe you have others, but either Daniel was very much aware of what was going on the second he walked into the room and was disgusted by it, by yet another display of arrogance towards the Most High God by a king of Babylon. Or he knew what the end game was. And it's likely a combination of both, I think. Yeah, Dwayne?
My opinion is that a lot of his attitude is a broken
code. Dwayne says he's cranky and crotchety because of his age.
Some of us pick things out in verses that are especially applicable to ourselves.
Sure. That was some insight that I certainly couldn't have. So Daniel begins by telling this story that is fresh in our minds because we just read it last Sunday, right? But he tells the story of Nebuchadnezzar being humbled. He tells how Belshazzar's forebear was so proud and arrogant before God that he was humbled and he was sent from his own kingdom and he was made to live like an animal until he recognized God's power. So here we actually see the retelling of this story. To people who are fairly removed from it, you know, 23 years isn't nothing. Did you have a comment, Darlene? Yeah, that's a great point. Darlene was just saying if you compare this statement to the way Daniel spoke to Nebuchadnezzar, at least before there was some kind of a tone of respect, here you don't really see that. Daniel's pulling no punches.
I rest my case.
And Dwayne rests his case.
He also in this reading, telling of this story, he also Daniel doesn't just reference Nebuchadnezzar as Belshazzar's like most powerful forebear. He certainly was. He was like the primary king in Babylonian history. But he references where that power came from and why Nebuchadnezzar was able to do all of those things he was able to do. And unlike Belshazzar, who's drinking out of the temple vessels, even though Nebuchadnezzar was a pagan king in every way possible, the Lord lifted him up and the Lord took him down and the Lord lifted him up again. And I think it's interesting that Daniel doesn't just go straight to the interpretation of what's going on. He makes certain that Belshazzar understands the relationship that his most powerful forebear had with God, whether or not Nebuchadnezzar wanted that relationship.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's kind of the last thing I wanted to share. I appreciate you kind of encapsulating that. As we go into this final section of the chapter, consider the fact that there's a contrast being drawn here. You know, Daniel spends a lot of time explaining the back and forth status that Nebuchadnezzar went through. He was proud and arrogant. He was humbled. Then he recognized God. He was raised back up. You, Belshazzar, you're proud and you're not humble. End of story. So what does that imply that the future holds for Belshazzar? And also, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, going off of what Darlene said a moment ago, Daniel hasn't delivered the interpretation yet. And he just finished admonishing the king in front of 1,000 of his nobles. And I just want to underscore the courage of Daniel to you for a minute. I don't think any of us can really relate to what that would have been like. I imagine nobles sitting all around whispering with each other, looking shocked, thinking, this guy's about to lose his head. Maybe not, but that's what I envision in this scene. Because Daniel hasn't even done the thing, he hasn't even made good on the portion of his reputation that even earned him a reputation into this room. And before he does that, he chastises this king for his blatant disrespect of the Most High God. That's the courage of the prophet Daniel. At least as I see it in this chapter. So he's about to read the inscription and give us the interpretation, finishing out here in verse 25. Now this is the inscription that was written out. Many, many tekel upharsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. Okay, so Belshazzar gets this interpretation and he goes ahead and he honors Daniel. Why? Conjecture, purely conjecture, but why? Why would he go ahead and do that?
Kings that are trying to unite their nobles cannot make promises in front of them. They cannot honor those promises.
Okay, so he made a promise publicly in front of 1,000 nobles. He's got to make good on it. Sure. I also wonder if in Belshazzar's heart, he's hoping, if I go ahead and treat this prophet of the Most High God nicely, maybe I can avoid this fate. We're not told that. It's just pure conjecture. So that same night, continuing on in verse 30, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. We didn't waste any time there. It's over and done with. That very night, Belshazzar is removed from power. Think about these words. You've been weighed in the balance, and you've been found lacking, and therefore you lose everything. God doesn't give Belshazzar a second chance. He is slain that very night. And that more or less marks the end of Babylonian power as the world dominant power, as far as I know. Dwayne.
This meaning is forbidden. It means God has never led your kingdom brought to an end. God has never led your kingdom brought to an end. So, with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's just a few applications and lessons I want to pull out of this for us. And some of them are left over from last chapter. To me, the same themes are still there. The ultimate seat of authority is in heaven. And once again, a king of a world power is brought low. He's humbled because of his arrogance and his pride and his offensiveness towards the Most High God. And God can do this as easily as he does anything else. He hates a proud heart, and so I want to encourage all of us again this morning, when we reflect on our lives and when we reflect on the position that we're in, good or bad, where do those thoughts lead? You know, do they lead towards thanking ourselves and patting ourselves on the back for what we have and what we're able to do for ourselves and for our family, let's say, or when you're thinking about you and your life relative to the people around you, the people that you can influence? Are you comparing yourself? Are you feeling happy and satisfied that you're better off and you're gratified? Or when I notice those things, am I trying to think, well, how can I be a good steward? How can I be a good possessor of the things that have been handed to me that I really, at the end of the day, had no ability to bring into this life for myself? Are we ever guilty of misusing the earthly treasures that were given? The way these nobles and the way Belshazzar were misusing the temple treasures. We're all temples of God. That's what Scripture tells us. How are we using the treasures that we keep inside our temples? How are we caring for those treasures? Are we ever guilty of misusing them? We've got to be careful about that. We've got to consider this celebration scene in Daniel 5 and consider what kind of celebration goes on in our heart from time to time. I know I have to consider it. I think we need to carefully consider these questions. You know, all Christians do. All people who want to be considered children of God need to consider these things. I don't ever want to be told by the Father, you've been weighed and you've been found lacking, so you lose. I don't want any of us to ever hear those words from the Father the way Belshazzar did. Maybe a sobering point to end on, but Belshazzar's life ended on a sobering point, and I think Daniel chapter 5 ends on a sobering point. Any other comments or questions before we wrap up? Yeah, Thank you for pointing that out. That's a slightly more positive note to end on. If you didn't hear Donna's comment, she said, as you read through Kings and Chronicles, maybe sometimes it's easy to think that all the Israelites are just evil, bad people, or they don't love God, they're disrespectful of God. You see how many times God had to punish the nation as a nation, but it's important to remember that there were faithful Israelites and there were faithful Hebrews like Daniel who still acknowledged the Most High God. And those are the historical figures in the Old Testament that you and I can emulate. Thank you, Donna. Thank you all for your comments and questions. We'll get into Daniel chapter 6 next week.